Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
With me, Steve Osborne, comic from San Francisco, Fran Duffy, NFL analyst, Philadelphia. I have a survey for you both. Instead of pitting Team Black against Team Green, instead we're going to pit the original series against the prequel series. Here is the first question of my survey. We'll start with you, Fran. Who's most likely to give you a sexually transmitted disease, King Aegon or King Robert?
Just because of longevity, I got to say it's probably King Robert, right? Mm. He's just been doing it longer. So I would say it's probably King Robert.
Very, very good. Steve, King Aegon or King Robert?
Yeah, I'm going to go with Robert, too, because somehow it feels like all of his STDs were pre-existing conditions, like that he was born with them.
Okay. Excellent. Excellent. All right, Steve, you go first on this one. Who writes the worst birthday card to his daughter, Tywin or Otto?
I think it's got to be Tywin, because I bet you he just kept on, like, writing a man's name instead.
He just can never remember Cersei's name.
Exactly.
All right, Fran, who writes the worst birthday card to his daughter, Tywin or Otto?
Yeah, it would probably be Tywin. Otto at least would probably finish it with, like, you've never seen more like your mother than you do right now. You know, some kind of semblance of nicety at the very end of it. So I think I'd probably
his classic sign off.
Yeah.
I'm afraid both of you are wrong. The answer is Otto, because the birthday card probably reads, "Go hang out with that gross king." All right, number three, Fran, you go first. Who writes the worst Valentine's Day card, Laris Hightower or Ramsay Snow?
Ooh.
Oh. Wow. The worst. I mean, it's got to be Ramsay. It's got to be Ramsay. He is just pure. I don't think there's any ounce of, like, affection in that guy whatsoever. Whereas Laris, I think there is, like, some, like, twisted level of, like, adoration there somewhere. I don't know. Like, it's somewhere under the surface. Mm-hmm. But I think with Ramsay, it's Ramsay.
Okay.
It's gotta be Ramsay.
Steve, worst Valentine's card writer, Laris or Ramsay?
So I think it's probably Ramsay. Even if the writing is nice, the card is probably made of skin.
Yeah,
and that's kind of a turnoff.
What else is in the box? Whatever. Yeah, right.
Yeah, I think Laris might have, like, a roses are red, violets are blue. Let's go to dinner, but lose that shoe.
Steve, you go first. Who's the bigger bummer at the New Year's Eve Christmas party, Kristen Cole or the Hound? Bigger bummer at the party, Kristen Cole or the Hound?
Wow, that's a really... Yeah, I think it's Kristen Cole. I just think... I mean, I feel like the Hound, at least when he's being a bummer, there's a certain... I don't know, I think of some of the parties I go to as an introvert, I'm looking for somebody who also doesn't want to be there, you know, and I feel he's the kind of guy that's like, yeah, dude, this place sucks, right? And he'll tell you something really serious about, like, you know what really sucks? Having your face burn. And you're like, all right, fine. Like, bro. But Kristen Cole just strikes me like, God, he's a little bit up his own keister.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, Fran, Kristen Cole or the Hound, worse bummer at the New Year's Eve party?
I feel like with the Hound, like at least he will partake in terms of being able to sit in the corner and drink. And there might be some like Lieutenant Dan and Forrest Gump energy where he's sitting there just sullenly as the confetti falls on his head. But I think when you look at Christian Cole, like he's trying to end and ruin the party and probably kills like two or three people in the process of it.
It's always a bummer.
I will go Christian Cole.
Yeah, very good. Okay. Steve, who would be worse to share a hot tub with? Old Viserys or late stage grayscale Jorah?
Oh, wow.
Worse to share a hot tub with, Viserys or Jorah?
Look, I don't exactly know what water and bubbles do to grayscale. I feel like if as long as it's like maybe one of those 6-person tubs, you know, I could just kind of, he would almost just kind of fall in there like an anchor and I probably wouldn't have to, I'd know where he was at. Whereas Viserys, this is just like, he's just like a loose leaf tea at this point.
Loose leaf tea is the winner of the podcast. Thank you. Thank you, Steve. Fran, who would be worse to share a hot tub with, Viserys or Jorah?
Well, I feel like if you leave Jorah in there long enough, like when he got grayscale, like didn't he, you know, you saw the stone men like come up from under the water. There's probably some fun tricks he could do in the hot tub. So I will go with Jorah probably being more fun, where I would just be completely skeeved out by Viserys in there at that point.
You guys are underestimating how pussy Jorah was.
prisoners of the moment. Yeah.
All right, Fran, you go first on this one. Who's the worst companion on a long road trip, grown-up Helena or grown-up Bran?
Oh. I have wondered if there will be some kind of connection there, because there are definitely similarities between these two. I guess probably Bran, because like he can not just only like tell you the future, but he could also like tell you some good stories from the past. And even though there's like, it's completely monotone. Like,
oh, you're saying he's the better. He's the better.
Yeah. So I would say I would say Lena would probably be the worst. Yeah.
Okay. So
Helena, she would say things. And now you're just trying to guess what's going to happen next. Whereas Bran like has some, ability to go forward and back.
All right, Steve, the worst companion on a long road trip, grown up Helena or grown up Bran?
I mean, everything that Fran says makes a ton of sense, but at the end of the day, I need just a little bit of eye contact.
Okay. So which one are we talking about?
So Bran's going to be worse. I mean, look, I'm on record saying he was the right king, but that doesn't mean I want to go anywhere with him.
Okay. Final question for you first, Fran. Who would you rather see in a Ferris Bueller's Day Off reboot, Varys or Laris?
I mean, I think that with Laris, you know, with that foot, he'd probably put the pedal to the metal in that car and send it through the glass window a little bit faster. I think that it's probably Laris. I'd probably want to see that. Although the movie might end a little faster, I think
I was
going to
say, shorter movie in that case. All right, Steve, would you rather see Laris Bueller's Day Off or Varys Bueller's Day Off?
So, yes, I think that's important to say who's who, like what the roles are, right? Because, I mean, I think Laris and the Cameron role would be ideal.
Yeah.
And Varys, you know what? Give me Varys. I'm going to go with Varys Bueller's Day Off just because I'm real curious to see what his song choice will be on the float.
Not Twist and Shout? You don't think?
I don't think he twists. And even if he does, I mean, I'm kind of curious to see how he pulls that off. Laris just trying to get on the float might be an issue. I don't know if we have that kind of time.
Hello, fandom. The new season of Electric Boogaloo is right around the corner. No reading is required. Just come hang out with your favorite characters. Remember the Hound and Sansa together way back when? Remember when Arya meets Jack and Hagar for the first time? And of course, each of my guests, in addition to being a very smart person, is a huge fan of the books and the shows. So that's what Electric Boogaloo is all about. But I am well aware that a lot of you tune in specifically for House of the Dragon talk. So here's my promise. I promise that at least for the first 10 episodes, I will include a bit of House of the Dragon conversation. So if you have a question for me or Steve or Aaron, or someone with a PhD in medievalism, you can send those to book@baldmove.com. So stick around for some hot D discussion, and then maybe stay a little longer to hear a surmise about Craster's religious devotion to the White Walkers. All right, sit back and enjoy a few clips from the upcoming season of Electric Boogaloo. Here is Oxford medievalist Catherine Olley. Martin likes to make you wonder, is this supernatural or not? But if I'm going to read this in a Lovecraftian way, I would wonder if Patchface has some special knowledge of these hybrid fish creatures, human fish creatures that Martin wants to occupy the margins of his story. And Kate, I see you smiling.
Yeah, that's kind of, I was, and this came up as we were talking about his attitudes to religion earlier as well. I was thinking as I was reading it, and this was kind of another of my questions, is his Patchface's kind of sojourn under the sea, can we tie that to the religion of the drowned god? And you know, is there evidence? Because I think Martin's quite even-handed in his treatment of religions. There's power to be found in almost all of the religions in some way, shape, and form. It's almost always limited as well.
Right.
But is this kind of possible evidence, you know, that there is this power under the sea that is something the Ironborn's religion is tapping into? And is this another indication there of, things under the sea, because that's, you know, that's how he begins all of his kind of musings, under the sea, what he knows, and he has essentially been through the ritual of the drowned god. He has been drowned and he has come back.
Here is Scottish historian Ian McInnes. I'm thinking of like Vaymond, I'm thinking of Damon, I'm thinking of Otto. Aemond, you know, there's a lot of second sons in this show. And I'm wondering if the problem for second sons is that they grow up not having a clear inheritance, or they grow up not having a clear path to power. If they want what their older brother has, they have to figure out how to take it somehow.
Yes. And I think that they are historical characters. You have someone like Edward III of England has a lot of sons and lives a long time. So as he's nearing his own end, you know, he has these various sons, but his heir has predeceased them, but has a male heir himself. So you have Richard II comes to the throne as a youth, as a teenage boy, but he's surrounded by all these royal uncles, some of whom are perfectly loyal and willing to help him, but they always act as that kind of alternative source of power. And you know, Damon potentially fills that role. You know, he is the heir presumptive until Viserys changes things and puts up Rhaenyra instead. But it's you know, him being in the background all the time is always a potential threat, and the small council recognizes that. Otto recognizes that. He knows exactly what Damon might do. That's what he spends the first couple of episodes trying to avoid. Or you get someone like King John, who is the youngest brother of four, and so probably thinks that he's never going to succeed. But by the accidental nature of things, by the time his elder brother Richard becomes king, John is the next in line. And when Richard disappears off on crusade for a couple of years, it's the perfect opportunity for John to try and make something of himself back in England, and he does. I think those younger sons are always quite interesting to watch in terms of how they develop. I think there are perfectly normal examples of ones who are perfectly loyal, absolutely do what their brothers or their nephews want them to do, and are the paragons of good behavior. But equally, there are a decent number of examples who aren't. And perhaps unsurprising, the latter category is more interesting.
Now, I've been thinking a lot about knighthood lately, and I want to try an idea on you.
Okay.
So recently I was interviewing someone who specializes in depictions of knights in medieval literature. And we were covering this movie, The Green Knight, on my other podcast. And I was thinking about, like, the dichotomy between the ideal knight as is depicted in literature and the realities of the politics of knighthood. So let me throw this at you, right? So there's this idea of chivalry which sort of makes the knight because of the code or whatever, but I think politically speaking, to have the office of a knight is a clear avenue for a second son, because they're not going to inherit the house. They're not going to inherit the lion's share of the lands. You need some office of prestige for that second son. So maybe knighthood fills that need. What would you say to that?
I think if we're talking about royal sons, though, or even noble sons, to be honest, I think all of them would expect to have knighthood. They would expect to be knighted at some point.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like they have an objective. They have an entitlement, you could say. And because they are given that entitlement, and I'm thinking of the ancient world, the second son is kind of out of luck. But in the medieval period, at least the second son can be called a knight, and that's prestigious enough, right?
Yeah, I suppose to a point, although I suppose I think of knighthood as not being an end in itself, that I think once you are a knight, you then have to kind of live up to expectations. So okay. you have to have the opportunity to demonstrate your qualities, whether that's bravery, strength, whether it's intelligence, whether it's, you know, various other attributes. Sure. We would associate with chivalry and with knighthood. So there still has to be an outlet for that, which is usually military. But I suppose in periods where there isn't war, then it has to be something else.
Right. Okay. So let me ask you this: do we have examples like Viserys, who people would associate as sort of, you know, you think of the king as sort of like the warrior in chief or something, but in reality, you know, you've got a lot of these lords who are knights in name only, that really never, you know, they never go to war, you know, these guys. So I'm wondering if we have examples of folks who live on the currency of the office, but never prove their worth in battle.
The interesting thing, though, is that medieval warfare is not as battle heavy as the literature might have us believe. It's rather like, you know, if you want to extend the Game of Thrones reference, it's like the romances that are always referred to, not living up to the reality of what the knights of Westeros actually are. And the same is true of the medieval world as well, that knights may reminisce about their experience in battle, and chivalric romances may wax lyrically about the experience of battle, but battles are actually relatively rare. Full-scale engagements. And so even your most chivalric of warriors for a long part of the medieval period haven't really fought in too many battles. Richard the Lionheart only fights in a couple of battles. William the Marshal, you know, the greatest knight of medieval Europe, only fights in two or three battles. He's far more active in sieges, in raids, and in tournaments. And so, you know, something like the tournament field, especially for younger knights, for younger sons, is absolutely an opportunity, because that's the way to absolutely demonstrate your skill, to show your worth, to demonstrate your bravery, but also to gain access to a lord's retinue, to effectively be hired and earn a living as part of that. If your father isn't going to give it to you, or your brother isn't going to give it to you, or if you're worried about your chances of progression, that's an alternative way potentially to do it. That can give you effectively a full-time job.
Yeah, and we actually do see that in the show a bit. I mean, you almost get the sense that the knights in the show haven't been tested in battle.
Yes.
It has been a time of peace, and so how do you test your mettle? You have to test it in tournaments and whatnot, right? Yeah. And Rhaenyra kind of makes a point of this when she's trying to decide who to promote to the Kingsguard, and that's sort of what Kristen Cole has that the other knights don't. Here is Professor of Gender Studies, Jan Doolittle-Wilson. Tyrion doesn't just have two levels, right? It's not just like surface level looks and then deeper, a little bit of purity. Martin's characters, his best characters, are complicated and have layers like onions, right?
Yes.
Tyrion, of course, is going to look a certain way on the surface, and then below there's going to be the courtesy, and then below is going to be, you know, there's just going to be 10 more layers down there, and he absolutely is going to murder his lover at one point in this story.
Yes. Or let's not forget, he murders Shay. He's
going to be driven by greed. You know, he's going to have opportunities to leave it all behind. He does not do it. Right. He's going to look down at Penny when they're connected. You know, he's going to project his own self-loathing onto her. So it's not like Tyrion is, you know, the monster with the heart of gold. He's got layers underneath his layers. And right. and of course, this is the world that Martin. This is one of the reasons we like characters like Jaime and like characters like Tyrion.
Oh, Jaime's one of my favorites. Please let me do a Jaime chapter with you at some point.
I'm sure we will get there eventually. It's such a pleasure to see how deep these characters go. And it is one of the ways that Martin, as a gardener, as he describes his writing style, he's going to dig. He's going to keep digging in one little bit of the garden until he finds something interesting there.
And those are the most, I think they're Martin's favorite characters, you know, the Tyrians and the characters with all of these layers. And I think viewers and readers are certainly drawn to characters who are much more complex. It reminds me of reactions to Daemon in House of the Dragon, right? Where I think we like him. He's awful. He's repulsive. And yet he has this weird code of loyalty. And he does the right thing at times, right? But he's very complicated. And it's been really interesting to read some of the commentary, the audience reaction to Daemon at this point, where kind of the defending of some of his actions that are actually pretty reprehensible. Mm-hmm. So I think that we like complex characters, but we still feel like we have to put them in these either or boxes, either you're a hero or you're a villain. And there aren't too many pure heroes or villains in Martin's tales.
There aren't.
The people that you like do really horrible things.
There aren't. However, I think that Daemon is just... I don't think he's... I don't know.
Is he just pure villain in your mind?
I'm not going to... He's not going to be redeemed.
No.
He's not a Jaime type. We're not going to see him sort of arc toward redemption.
But do you find yourself liking him at times?
I can't take my eyes off him. He's the most fascinating personality on the screen.
He really is.
I mean, I will watch him do horrible things all day long, but... I'm under no delusions that this guy has a noble center.
No,
he is chaos. He's chaos in the form of a human, you know?
I play into this too, though. So that, spoiler warning, that last episode of House of the Dragon where he chokes Rhaenyra.
Yeah.
I remember thinking, oh, but Daemon, you're doing something horrible. And then I realized that's who he is.
That's who
he is. Of course he's choking this person. Yep. He's not a good person, but I wanted him to be. So I get that impulse of, oh, please be a Jaime. You know, please be somebody we can root for. And that's not that kind of story. it's really not. I'm enjoying it.
I do wonder... Like, Martin does like anti-heroes, right? Sometimes I wonder, is that what we're watching with Tyrion?
An anti-hero,
because I do think, like, he does present as kind of a roguish protagonist. He does present more of a protagonist. In the same way that the books have taught me to root for Arya, encoding her in, you know, traditionally masculine ways, right?
Yeah.
The books and the show have taught me to root for Tyrion, and I wonder if this is going to be something that ends up breaking my heart in the end. So
I don't know. I think so much of it, too, is, you know, just, again, those point of view chapters. They direct the reader where to sympathize and where to see the world from that point of view. You know, and I think Tyrion, of any character, has the most point of view chapters across, you know, the books that we've gotten so far. So I think we're naturally kind of inclined, aside from the fact he's just a fascinating character with all of these layers that you mentioned, right? Mm-hmm. We see so much of the world from his point of view, which is why I love with later books, we start to get more characters who were really just kind of, we only saw them from other people's perspectives. I love when they start bringing in Jamie, of course, when we start getting Cersei's point of view, you start to see so much more from those characters because it's from their thoughts and we hear that inner monologue and we start to see other characters from a different angle because we've only ever seen them from a certain point of view. So I think it was a really brilliant, you know, writing strategy on Martin's part and how he shakes that up as we go through. You don't have the same point of view, you know, from all of the characters throughout the book. Some you do, you know, but many of them are introduced in later books, even though they seem to be main characters you know, early on.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have you on, Jan. And I was just doing a little search on, I'll find the next time Jamie shows up and I'll shoot you an invite. It might be a while, but
I will take you up on that for sure.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make. Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time. Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers. Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited. It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live. Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday. Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead, unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Here is Professor of English Literature Stephanie Barbehammer.
But the other moment in this text that I think is so wonderful and that shows us, sure, continuity, but also considerable evolution in terms of the skill set of this person is the actual fight with Hot Pie.
Okay.
Which is, again, as a writer, I so admire writers who can write action scenes. Action scenes are so hard to write because it's all action. It's physical. So how do you use words to demonstrate and make us feel, make us share what's happening? And the description is just fantastic.
Do you mind if I read it?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. Arya slid her practice sword from her belt. "You can have this one," she told Hot Pie, not wanting to fight. "That's just some stick." He rode near and tried to reach over for Needle's hilt. Arya made the stick whistle as she laid the wood across the donkey's hindquarters. The animal hawed and bucked, dumping Hot Pie on the ground. She vaulted off her own donkey and poked him in the gut as he tried to get up, and then sat back down with a grunt. She whacked him across the face and his nose, and made his nose crack like a branch breaking. Blood, blood. I shouldn't be laughing. This is violent, right? Blood dribbled from his nostrils when Hot Pie began to wail. Arya whirled toward Lommy Greenhands, who was sitting on his donkey, open mouthed. you want some sword to shield, but he didn't. It's
great. And I just want to stop for a second because we both laughed.
Yeah.
Because there's something, again, this is the genius of the author. There's something a little Three Stoogesy about it.
It is a
little
bit.
Crack.
Yeah.
And the falling on the ground. And of course, they're on donkeys, which is also funny.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They're not on steeds. They're not on stallions. They're on donkeys. So, and when Hotbai began to wail, he's this big guy who said, I killed somebody. I'm awful. I'm so bad. And he immediately starts to cry.
Yep. Yep.
So there is a little bit of comedy there for sure.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the stakes are somewhat lower because we know this is a practice sword. So it's not like, you know, we saw a horrific interaction that Arya had at the end of the last book.
Yes.
She ends up killing someone.
Yes.
She's on the run. She's afraid for her life. And she ends up stabbing a boy in the stomach.
Kills him. She's a murderer.
Yeah, it's an absolute, and she's a little bit, you know, she's certainly feeling guilt about it.
Yeah.
She mentions it here in this chapter. Yeah, she doesn't want to tell Yoren that she's done this. But she kind of knows I have something in common with these men that Yoren dragged out from the Black Cells.
Right. She keeps on looking at the guys and the three really scary guys. She keeps looking at them, perhaps recognizing a little bit of herself in them.
Yeah, I think so. And she's not quite comfortable with that. This is kind of she's taken her first steps toward this death religion.
Yes, true.
She's not, we don't have her reciting her list yet, but you kind of see the seeds of that. She's named Joffrey as sort of the person that's most responsible for Ned's death.
Yes.
So,
the list is forming.
The list is forming for sure. We have at least one name. All right, stick around on this feed. Next week, we will begin with Chapter 1 of A Clash of Kings. It's Arya's first chapter on the road, where she meets Hot Pie and the Bull, and, although not named yet, Jack and Hagar. If you're interested in my full roundtable discussion on the prologue of Clash of Kings, that is available now at Double Dragon. And that is all for this week.